Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Greatly appreciate all of y'all taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats, whether you're with us live or getting us via the podcast. And if you're with us live, if you go to the show page, scroll down near the bottom, that's where you'll find the chat room. If you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, that's a great place to go to do that. And we'll be monitoring it during the course of the show. So if there's a question you would like for either one of us to direct to our guest, it doesn't look like we're quite heading in the direction you'd like us to, go ahead and put that in the chat room. We will grab it and fold it in as the show goes forward. And if you got to run off and take care of a few things and you want to see what you missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or just take the shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes. And for today's show, we are going to return to a subject we have obliquely brought up with some of our previous guests, but really haven't dove deep into it. It's that thing that most everybody during the course of their life has seen, that whenever there is a global crisis, whether it's man-made, a natural disaster, whether it's strictly civilians affected, or especially if it's a security-related issue, the world sooner or later turns their eye to the United States and asks, what is America going to do? We hear phrases such as the indispensable nation, the only global superpower. You've heard all the descriptions. And especially in the quarter century, yes, it has been that long, since the end of the Cold War and going 16 years into the Long War, more and more people are looking at exactly what that means in our global situation as it is morphed here in the second decade of the 21st century. Is it an honor or a burden to be where we are? And is it a habit that we could, should, or can sustain into the future? And our guest today for the full hour to discuss this and other related issues is Christopher Preble, the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. And kind of as a starting off point for the listeners, if you wanted to see where we're coming from, is an article that he co-authored over at War on the Rocks, and you can find it in a few other places, with William Ruger, titled No More of the Same, The Problem with Primacy. Christopher, welcome to Midrats.
It's an honor to be here. Thanks a lot.
Yes, sir. And I threw out a few words there in the beginning, and just kind of to set the table, let's look at just the phrases that we're using.
Right.
Global hegemony, primacy, the indispensable nation. As we and the international community looks at it, what do they mean when they use those phrases with regard to the U.S.?
Well, the terms are used somewhat interchangeably, but they are a little bit different. Let's just treat what I use as a shorthand and my colleagues use as a shorthand for describing U.S. grand strategy since at least the end of the Cold War is primacy. Sometimes you'll hear benevolent hegemony or liberal hegemony or something like that. It was spelled out fairly clearly in the waning days of the Bush 41 administration, talking about the United States maintaining its dominant military presence in all around the world and discouraging other countries from developing or challenging U.S. power anywhere in the vital regions, being Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. This had a clear logic behind it. It stems from the concern that if countries were to resort to their typical ways, they would engage in arms race behavior or other risky behaviors that would eventually draw the United States in. It was felt that the United States, having prevailed in the Cold War, had this massive military in being. We could sustain this presence fairly easily without great effort, not at great cost. And, you know, basically it was a good deal for everybody. Around the same time, or slightly later than that, in the mid-1990s, the idea cropped up of the indispensable nation, which is related, basically means that any problem in the world, the United States will be involved in fixing. It doesn't mean necessarily that the United States is going to be the main player involved, but the argument being that really nothing gets solved without the United States at least being heavily involved in it. It's generally attributed to President Clinton invoked the phrase, but Madeleine Albright as well, a few others. And I think it prevails really pretty widely in the city where I work, the Washington, D.C. I think many people on both the political left and the political right think as they can disagree on lots and lots of different things, but they basically agree on the key tenets of U.S. foreign policy, which is pretty much as I described them. The United States should continue to do what it's been doing for the last 25 years, that this talk that we cannot sustain it going forward is false, that with a little determined leadership and a little bit more effort, it could be extended indefinitely. And as the article explains, my colleague and friend Will Ruger and I are critical of that, and we explore that at some length in that article.
When I was looking at this article, one of the things that popped in my head almost immediately was the Weinberger Doctrine, which I think kind of anticipated where you guys are in this, at least on paper or in theory, where he was saying we shouldn't intervene in any things that don't affect the U.S. national interest. But he went further, I think, and said the national interest of the U.S. and its allies.
And its allies, correct.
Yes. How do we define the U.S. national interest? I know that's a big question. Or who defines the U.S. national interest?
Right. I mean, it's the critical question, and I think there are likely to be debates. My colleagues and I, we believe that the core vital U.S. national interests are not so different from any other country's national interests. That is, the territorial integrity and independence and sovereignty of your own country, the security of your citizens, the ability of your citizens to live and prosper, those are all core vital U.S. national interests. And again, I think it wouldn't be any differently defined from any other country around the world, no matter how small or large. That's sort of basic. Beyond that, of course, the United States has often defined its interest not merely in security or prosperity terms, but also along the lines of values and therefore in universal human rights, and therefore it's not enough to concern yourself with the rights and liberties of your own citizens, but if you see other people around the world being oppressed or suffering or whatnot, that those are also vital interests. I disagree, but again, I think it's worthwhile to at least debate those things. I would come back. I'm glad you raised the Weinberger Doctrine, because I think there is a lot of the work that I've done that borrows from that. And a country like the United States that has such vast military power, and we do, is always going to be tempted to use it. And so the Weinberger Doctrine and later the Powell Doctrine, and of course Powell was Weinberger's assistant when the first doctrine was promulgated, they were pretty sensitive to this temptation that we would get drawn into conflicts. They were, of course, reacting after the Marine mission, the disaster in Beirut in 1982, 83. And so they were trying to prevent that sort of thing from happening in the future. The difference then, of course, we were operating in the Cold War, and now it's a different environment still. So I think that some criteria like that are useful. Again, we can debate what they are and how they should be defined. But in the same series that you mentioned, War on the Rocks, where Will Ruger and I wrote, I also wrote a separate essay in the same series talking about the new rules for war, which, again, borrow and adapt from the Weinberger and Powell doctrines.
One of the interesting arguments when it comes to how much we spend on our defense has been, you know, if not us, who? And it all comes back from it, and you roughly outlined it. You know, after World War II, there was actually Truman did what was back to the American tradition, we're not at war, we're going to downshift. And then Korea kicked in, and then Eisenhower came in and new look and off and running for the Cold War. Cold War has been over for a quarter century, but it still is both internally and externally the expectation that the U.S. needs to be this colossus astride the globe, and, you know, pick whatever reason you want to for it. And is it almost a national psychological habit or addiction that everybody has gotten to? Or is there a no-kidding requirement that we get a net gain from as a nation, and you can look at it in strictly selfish purposes as you want to, that we have to be as big and dominant as we are?
I don't think it's a requirement. I think it is mostly through force of habit. And the reasons are, we can sort of unpack the arguments made on behalf of primacy or on behalf of this dominant military posture. First of all, the United States of America is an enormous country. It's physically large, and it's also the wealthiest country in the world. And so it is, by those standards alone, the United States would have a large military and a costly military. I'm not disputing that at all. But I think that our geography is still fairly auspicious, and geography still matters. And therefore, if you look at the way, not merely the size of the U.S. military, but the way that it is arrayed around the planet, it's not chiefly focused, or certainly not primarily focused, on defense of the United States and U.S. territory. It has a broader mission. You can sort of tell just by virtue of the way that we're the bases we have and the way that we deploy our ships and things like that. There are three arguments, basically. I alluded to one of them, which is that if you don't have a single country in this powerful position, basically calming the various neighborhoods around the world, that the neighbors will get nervous and they might start to fight with one another. And you know, this the logic comes from the wars in Europe in the for much of modern European history, and now we look to Asia and the nervousness that would be aroused by a Japan that was spending, for example, 2% of GDP on defense as opposed to 1%, or things like that. So that's one argument, is that the presence around the world tamps down security competition, which ultimately leads to peace. The second argument is that the functioning of the global economy is absolutely dependent on the power of a single state to enforce it. And the model here is the British Navy in the 19th century, at a time when, of course, much of the world was divided up between various trading blocs, and it was much more of a zero-sum game, I think, than it is today. Today, there are many countries, in fact, the vast majority of countries, who benefit from the open international trading system, and I think it's therefore unrealistic to think that only one country, which again arguably benefits the most or certainly benefits a lot, that not a single country, the United States, should be responsible for it. So that's where I object to that. And the third part is the likely reaction of adversaries. The question is, are adversaries likely to back down in the face of U.S. threats consistently, or are those threats over time likely to become less credible? In other words, once upon a time, it was a credible claim that the United States would treat an attack on any Western European country from the Soviet Union as synonymous with an attack on the United States. But are we to expect the same level of commitment from all U.S. leaders, irrespective of who they are and where they come from, sort of their life experiences, forever? This is where I believe that traditional deterrence, when you're deterring an attack on your own country, is more effective than deterring an attack on someone else's extended deterrence. for those three reasons, I think primacy makes certain claims and expects certain things. It expects that we have a net benefit to be gained from other countries not doing more to defend themselves, that the deterrence will always work, and that the United States would never be dragged into conflicts that we might otherwise avoid, or that the deterrence would be superior if it was provided by the actual contestants in the conflict. And lastly, the international economy is far more resilient and robust than it was 150 years ago, and it's far more open. There's far more commitment to the principles of free exchange, and therefore a lot of the things that we've done by force of habit just haven't been scrutinized very closely. Now, I will say they have been scrutinized at some length in the academic community. So you can pick up an issue of international security or security studies or various journals over the years, and you will find critics of primacy, critics of liberal hegemony. And they have made their arguments, but they tend not to be represented well inside of Washington, because the people who come to Washington buy into this grand strategy. If they didn't, they wouldn't be here. And so the cycle just continues, and it's never really scrutinized very closely.
One of the things you address in your second essay in that series you were talking about, the new rules for the U.S. military, had to do with the fact that, in your view, as I gather it, that the use of the word national interests of its allies is far too broad to provide guidance the way it should for our U.S. any application of U.S. military force. Mm-hmm. Am I correct in restating your view? And if so, can you kind of explain a little bit?
Yeah, you are correct. I think that to suggest that U.S. national interests are synonymous with the national interests of other countries, including our allies, is, frankly, a little absurd. They often align, and that's good, but they're not always the same. And I think we just have to be honest with ourselves and especially with our allies to state very clearly, while we care very deeply about an open international trading system and we care about the security of other parts of the world, I just think it's unreasonable to expect the United States to treat their security interests as exactly the same as our own. There are so many different ways to state this. One of my favorite examples... Quite a few years ago, Francis Fukuyama wrote a book called America at a Crossroads. It was right after the Iraq War, 2005, 2006, thereabouts. And I reviewed it at the American Conservative, and a number of other people reviewed it. It got a lot of attention because Fukuyama had been a supporter of the Iraq War and then sort of turned on some of his neoconservative compatriots. But there was a passage in there where Professor Fukuyama talks about the absurdity of the American exceptionalism and the claim that the United States would treat the interests of other countries as synonymous with their own. He said that couldn't possibly be believed or believable. If that were true, then American leaders, American presidents, American politicians weren't really fulfilling their primary obligation to the citizens that elect them. More recently, there's another great book which we've featured at Cato by Elizabeth Hoffman called American Umpire. And the point that I make is that the United States isn't an umpire. Umpires don't play the game. Umpires have different colored uniforms for a reason. Umpires are not interested in who wins or loses. Well, the United States is clearly interested in wins and losses. We want to win. And therefore, it seems rather absurd to think that one country is going to subsume its interests when those interests conflict with others. Now, again, the good news is that most of the things that we do around the world on behalf of others are genuinely consistent with U.S. vital national interests, and therefore there is no conflict. The tough cases are tough cases for a reason. They're the cases where our interests don't align. And I think we see many cases, even in the current context, where difficult questions arise over what exactly is the United States doing and why. Yemen, Syria, South China Sea, even Korea. I could go down the list, and you ask the question very simply, what exactly does this have very specifically to U.S. vital national security interests, and might it be true that the countries that are in the region or nearby have more at stake than we do? And maybe their interests don't even align with ours. That kind of conversation, the whole notion of primacy, which supposes that we're going to treat other countries' interests as seriously as we do, and that there is no conflict, primacy can't even entertain those sorts of discussions because it just assumes that our interests are universal and therefore there is no conflict.
You can also look at nations' priorities based upon where they invest their time and effort. And smarter people than me have made the observation that many of our global allies have these great and wonderful welfare states because, well, we've subsidized a lot of their national defense,
right,
which gives them extra budget space to go. And this is how much a nation, if you want to be our friend and our ally, so to speak, and you expect us to put our blood and treasure to back your play. That discussion predates the present administration, but it's definitely broken above the ambient noise with the 2% mark. And you can find this discussion in the Bush and the Obama administration as well. But what's interesting is when you look at the threat to, quote, the West, unquote, and its auxiliary cultures, nothing that we see today, in my opinion at least, get anywhere close to the threat of the Soviet Union in the height of the Cold War and from the early 60s through the end of the 80s. And when you look at the end of the 80s, the U.S. as a percentage of GDP spent 5.6% of its GDP on defense. The U.K. spent 3.8%. Belgium even spent 2.5%. Germany, 2.5%. That was 1988. So when you come to last year, the reduction from that end of the Cold War high, the U.S. defense budget's 58% of what it was. The Brits and the Germans are 50%. The Belgians are 36%. Ironically, Japan, as a percentage of GDP, has remained the same.
Yeah.
So when you look at the Cold War spectrum and how much we really need to be spending, we still have a little bit more of a relative effort than our allies do. Do they perceive the threat differently than we do, or do they feel comfortable with a substantially less effort than we do because they know that we're there?
Well, I don't think those questions are an either or. I think they don't perceive the threat to be as serious as we do, and in part they don't see the threat the same way as we do because we are providing a degree of security. Now, it's possible that in the absence of U.S. security guarantees to Europe, for example, that the Europeans would survey the current situation and say, we still feel secure even without the United States standing over our shoulder. The kinds of challenges that we're facing are not an existential threat like the Red Army lodged in Eastern Europe, but terrorism and radicalism and things like that, which are serious concerns, but are concerns that are not best dealt with by military forces, and feel like their current level of spending is sufficient to deal with the problem. The problem, of course, is being in social science, we can't rerun the experiment without the United States security guarantee in place. So it's sort of hard to tell. I think that the way the United States has defined our mission as being more than just vital defense of U.S. interests, but defending others, has actively discouraged other countries from doing more. And let's be clear, two things. First, this was by design. Even going back in history, at the time when the United States, as you point out, Harry Truman had initially cut back on military spending quite dramatically, as most Americans wanted him to. The war was over, but recognized pretty quickly that the United States was going to have to be in a much stronger position because our allies, the countries we cared most about in Europe and in East Asia, were badly broken and really on the verge of catastrophe. And for them to be expected to to defend themselves essentially alone, or even just the few of them together against the Soviet Union, was rather unrealistic. So I wouldn't have done anything differently, to be perfectly honest, had I been in that same situation. The trouble, or it's not trouble, it's that we succeeded very well. These countries are wealthy and, as you point out, safe. They feel safe. That's a great success. That's a great achievement. But I think it begs us to revisit the basic bargain that we would continue to do this effectively forever, forever being a long time. The other point I want to make, just so we don't lose track of it somewhere along the line, is that the American people were never really asked about this. It never really came up. There was a moment at the time around the Marshall Plan and the Truman Doctrine, again, where, you know, there was this quite legitimate concern about the Soviet military, and not long after that, and Soviet nuclear weapons and whatnot, the entire context of the Cold War. Americans perceived that the security we were providing to others definitely, you know, did serve our interests as well, because it would just be just too horrible to contemplate the idea of another war in Europe after the first two, we had just gone through. But we never revisited that, and we never really asked the American people sort of where they were. And when you did ask, when pollsters did ask, you always found this huge gap between the elites, the foreign policy elites, and the public at large. The public at large, for the most part, thought the U.S. military was supposed to defend the United States and that other countries were primarily responsible for defending themselves. It never really rose, as you say, above the level of noise, because you had very few politicians over the years who ever said anything that even hinted that there was that there was a problem here, that there was a gap between the public and their leaders, and Donald Trump did that, and he did it in a very, haphazard way. It appears to have been not through any careful study or anything like that. It was just more of an instinctive sense on his part that there was some sort of a raw deal here. In that sense, he was sort of reflecting the views of a good number of Americans who don't pay very close attention to foreign policy on a regular basis, but they just look like a raw deal. As you point out, the differences in percentage of GDP spent on defense and where those dollars are spent. When you're not spending on defense, what else are you doing? And that's where the energy behind the nation building at home instinct creeps in. So if we believe that some of the money that we're spending overseas could be better spent here at home, suddenly the kinds of trade-offs that we didn't have to contemplate when we were fat, dumb, and happy. Someone once said, when you run out of money, then you really have to think. And that's sort of where we are right now. You can't actually sustain this level of military activity and spending and also maintain high levels of domestic spending. You have to make some tough choices. Or you have to raise taxes, which is also an option, which many people are reluctant to do. So my hope is that if nothing else, this whole weird political season that we experienced over the last year and a half has brought to the surface some debates that have just been sort of on hold for a long time. And I think it's already starting to happen a little bit.
Yeah, and speaking of debates been on hold for a long time, it seems to me that I was recently watching the PBS series on the Great War, about World War One,
right.
and the maneuvering that Wilson did to get the U.S. into the war. If you were to point backwards in history to how we end up in the situation where we now provide so much security for the rest of the world, does it begin with Wilson, or has there ever been an instinct? Always been an instinct in the American Republic to look abroad and protect other people.
No, in fact, there was a pretty sharp divide, I think, in American history and U.S. foreign policy. Walter McDougall, a professor at University of Pennsylvania, who's one of my favorite observers on U.S. foreign policy, he defines it in his book, The Promised Land versus the Crusader State. The founders, and for most of the first half or longer than that, years of U.S. history, They looked at the purpose of U.S. foreign policy was to create a society here in North America that was worthy of emulation. We would trade with other countries. We would have diplomatic relations with other countries. But we wouldn't try to impose our values by force, and we wouldn't define our security interests as being, as so far afield as they have today. That changed in the beginning of the 20th century. There was greater interest. Again, it's a function of wealth. It's a function of our relative security. We had dealt with the security challenges, many of them in North America. We began to sort of define the security perimeter out farther and farther away from our shores. And then, again, the experience of World War II, the inability or failure or a bit of both for the United States to intervene more decisively sooner in the war was seen as a great mistake, and therefore we're never going to repeat that. And thus, you have ever since 45, or really more accurately 47 or 48, there was a very short time right after World War II where we sort of took a little bit of a step back. But really effectively since 47 or 48, the United States has had a very major presence in at least the three major regions of the world, Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. And that it hasn't really changed. You know, the numbers have come down a little bit, but the basic outline hasn't changed.
This try to avoid sounding too cynical here, but a little bit of cynicism is good for the soul when it comes into this. In your article, and I want to tie back into a previous work you did last summer, you brought up another way, I guess, of putting the bipartisan consensus out there with a default foreign policy. And back in July of last year, you and our buddy Emma Ashford put out an article, and I'll do a little bit of an extended quote here from the second paragraph of the article. Quote, "Instead, policymakers and political candidates generally embrace the status quo. Bipartisan support exists for extensive alliance commitment, frequent military intervention, and higher defense spending. Though this orthodoxy is unsurprising, since many candidates receive advice from a limited number of sources, it is deeply concerning. Debates tend to focus on which specific actions the United States should take, only rarely asking whether the United States should be involved, military or otherwise, in various global crises." Unquote there. And what that brought me thinking about is, speaking of one of our new terms from the last election, and that's a word that describes many mutual friends of ours, the D.C. blob, the National
Yeah.
Security Diplomatic
Yeah.
Industrial Complex, where inside D.C. in that crystalline environment, there are a lot of people who have their jobs, their egos, their life work all wrapped up in this default foreign policy, in this bipartisan consensus of what do we do next. And
right.
There's a lot of inertia there. And when you have big organizations with a lot of inertia, you're always looking for that internal, external shock that gives an opportunity for the right leader who's there to be able to go in and make some effective change, to really make some changes outside of the default foreign policy. Do you think we would have to have some type of shock to force that change, or are there some leaders that might have some influence out there that you think might have some traction to make some changes?
Well, I got
like I said,
I
try to avoid cynicism, but
I got to say that Donald J. Trump is pretty shocking to a lot of people in Washington, D.C. So I don't think he by himself is sufficient to be the shock that you talk about, but it's an uncomfortable little jolt. I think that it's perfectly understandable why the United States has continued the way it has. We're not so people don't like to make hard choices or make decisions unless they absolutely have to. And in fairness, people can survey the way that the United States and the way the world has operated since the end of World War II, and say, gee, things seem to be going reasonably well. There's been no great power war. The global economy is, in spite of all of its challenges, the simple fact is that hundreds of millions and even billions of people have been lifted out of desperate poverty. The state of the world is actually quite good. And that surely, and oh, by the way, the Cold War ended peacefully without the thermonuclear war that we were so desperately afraid of for many years. So by that standard, things seem to be working fairly well. What's the problem? Why change what's not broken? Why fix what's not broken? And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I think that goes a long ways to explain why so many people in Washington are committed to the status quo. There's one big problem. They've got to pay for it. And the American people have signaled fairly clearly that that's not really what they have in mind. And, you know, I'd be the first to say I have ideas about how this should be sustained. And I would refashion U.S. foreign policy to be more consistent with what the American people are willing to provide. But someone else could come along and say, no, I've got a solution. I know how to get the American people to spend much more and to look upon this mission as something worth sustaining for another 45 or 50 years. So the money is the big issue. And I'll say, on one sense, it's not very much. It's not much as a share of GDP, as we pointed out. It's still large as in real dollar terms. We're spending more on average, even under the Budget Control Act, the caps that were put in place back in 2011 and have been adjusted several times along the way. We're still spending more on average than we did during the average year of the Cold War, so in real dollar terms. So that's a pretty substantial amount of money. But in an environment where every single dollar is a deficit spent, or virtually every dollar is just spending into the future, there need to be offsets. We need to have cuts somewhere, cuts in programs that people like, but because they want these sorts of spending more, or tax increases. And that kind of debate it's ongoing, but you just don't see any resolution. The two sides are fairly well dug in, and in that environment, the military has been compelled to make do with less than they want. But what I haven't seen yet, to be very honest with you, is a rethinking of the strategy. So instead, the military's cut into readiness and training and things like that. But the overall force posture really hasn't changed all that much. And I think that's something that's not—it's not wise. It's bad for the troops, and it's ultimately, it could be fairly dangerous if it really does undermine operational effectiveness.
That puts me in mind when we're talking about alternatives to the foreign policy. One of the questions I always have relate to these humanitarian interventions that have popped up, and I think the first one I recall was the one in Somalia, which has, you know, we have all these unintended consequences that have followed from these things. Somalia, Kosovo, Libya, you know, we're saving people from their governments, and then we end up with situations that apparently were not foreseen, although many of us who served in Kosovo could have foreseen some of the later ones. But is that another one of these issues that there's groupthink in D.C.? Somebody says, well, you know, we got starving people in Yemen now. We got starving people in South Sudan.
We have starving people in our own hemisphere in Venezuela, you know, so.
Yeah, well, I was going to go there. So, yeah, all right. Should we, is that another one of these concerns we should say, no, that's really not in our national interest? Or is there an argument that starving people anywhere create this unsettled atmosphere that could cause us issues down the road? Or is that just an argument that's stretched out too far?
I think that the main problem is that we don't think through each of these instances on a case-by-case basis because the impulse is to do something. And because, on the surface at least, the United States always can do something. We have the capability to do something. Most other countries, in fact, I would submit that no other country can act essentially everywhere all the time. Not all at the same time, but you know, we aren't really limited in these sorts of relatively small-scale operations. It goes back to, I wrote many years ago a book called The Power Problem, and the lead of that book is the famous quote between, or a discussion between, Madeleine Albright and Colin Powell. Madeleine Albright was the UN ambassador, and Colin Powell was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs under President Clinton. And Albright said to Powell, "What's the point of this wonderful military you're always talking about if we can't use it?" And Powell's response was, "You know, American GIs are not toy soldiers to be moved around on a global chessboard. You know, there's something more than just we can act." And yet, this impulse to act is practically overwhelming. It requires an enormous amount of discipline on the part of the President of the United States, who has this power at his disposal, and to not use it appears, frankly, rather callous. And that's, no one wants to be in that sort of situation. And so that's part of the reason why I stress the rules, the guidelines for the use of force. I think that had we debated publicly, had Congress, God forbid, actually debated whether or not the United States should have gone to war in Libya, for example, it would have been an interesting discussion. I think that at the time of the famous Syrian red line, and when Bashar Assad crossed the red line in 2013, I think President Obama would have had a hard time getting the votes to support it, even a resolution of support. I think Congress was hearing quite strongly from the American people that that wasn't worth intervening. Here's the difference. Humanitarian crises that are caused by civil conflict, which many are, those are very hard to solve because ultimately it means solving the underlying civil conflict that's giving rise to the suffering in the first place. And as we've learned many times over, and yet we continue to relearn the same lesson, building foreign countries is really hard. In other instances, when there is, for example, a natural disaster, an earthquake, a tsunami, something like that, when there is just massive human suffering and the U.S. military and the U.S. Navy in particular has this enormous capacity in a very short amount of time to ameliorate suffering, to save lives, I have no particular quarrel with the United States military acting in those fashion, even though it would define my own rules about it in the service of the U.S. national interest. Why? Because the costs are very, very low, because the benefits are reasonably high. That is, you're able to save large numbers of lives. But in so many cases, it's not nearly that simple. In so many cases, when you ask what's the military mission, what is actually the military going to do in terms of separating the warring factions, and then what? You know, Somalia was a perfect case. It wasn't merely that the people were starving. It was that warlords were denying people access to food, which means taking on the warlords, which means getting involved in a civil war. Lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. So my main frustration is the disconnect between the appearance of having, you know, the ability to do something and the reality that just doing something on the surface doesn't actually solve the underlying problem. And therefore, what have you done? You may have made an improvement at the margin, but you haven't made a long-term contribution. And in the process, you've risked the lives of American service members, you've risked capital and things like that. And I think that's why, at a minimum, we should have a pretty robust debate when we undertake those sorts of operations.
Yeah, I think that's one occurrence that you have to give a nod to the mother country. The British Parliament actually voted on whether to do anything in Syria, and
right.
Then Prime Minister Cameron got a pretty firm no.
Right.
I think that was really healthy. And this is kind of a hard question, but it's something – that
I thought they were all hard questions.
They're all hard questions. it's hard because it requires a cold realist view. And I'm glad you brought up Somalia, because throughout human history, that will be true for the rest of human history, starvation has always been a tool of warfare. Especially civil warfare, cutting off resources. I can tell you stories from where I live, from a U.S. Civil War. I mean, that's the way things go. And we saw the latest attempt, and it always concerned me that what was called, you don't hear it called as much anymore, the CNN effect. During the siege of Aleppo, siege warfare also arguably is actually more humane now than it has been in human history. But a siege is a siege, and
you know, the garrison always eats first, et cetera, and so forth. But we still, in spite of our experience in Somalia and countless other places, but again, unfortunately, the discussion usually is, you know, what has been history in your lifetime. You have really smart, influential people, otherwise smart, influential people, and I think she's great, and I'm not speaking ill of her, but I'll just use her as an example. S.E. Cupp out there, who was constantly pushing these very sad but very realistic, because that's war, pictures of the children, as if all children are being injured during that. Trying to do something. Mm-hmm. How do those who would like to have a more mature and broader discussion push back against that instinct to do something that's emotional-based, almost propaganda-esque? But these are well-meaning people, but they're well-meaning people that have influence, and then we're going to find ourselves in another Mogadishu or arguably some of the places in the Balkans. How do you argue against that?
The first thing you do is what you say is admit up front that these people are motivated by noble human instincts to help their fellow man, to alleviate suffering, to save lives. Those are noble instincts. And I think you have to say that up front, and you have to admit that some of these situations are really quite gut-wrenching. There are innocent civilians being injured and killed, and that is very, very hard for people to accept. And again, this is the impulse of the United States. Americans feel as though we have this power to fix these problems, and therefore we want to go out and do it. The problem is that And I think we've learned this to a certain extent over the last 15 or 18 years, is that we don't actually have the power to solve these problems. We have the problem to maybe make some minor, you know, help at the margins, but really, really fixing the underlying problems is exceptionally hard. Where it can work is when you have an outside actor, someone who's willing to intervene in a conflict as a mediator or something like that, but really has the staying power to stick it out. Says, look, we care enough about this to want to invest the resources necessary to actually make it work. Well, lo and behold, the factor that explains a country's willingness to do that also has to do with their national interest. If they perceive there's a national interest at stake, they're much more likely to invest those resources and invest that time in order to help. What does that mean? The countries in the region have more to lose and more to gain. And therefore, the countries in the region, and again, we don't have to just define not just Somalia, we talk about Syria, we talk about other cases, we talk about Europe during the late 1990s, Kosovo and Bosnia. Those types of situations where the neighboring states would, under normal circumstance, have a strong incentive, an impulse to help, both a combination of their humanitarian instincts and also their national security instincts. But primacy discourages that sort of behavior. The argument that the United States is the indispensable nation sends a message to every other country in the world that if the United States doesn't act, no one else will act. That is exactly the wrong message to send. The United States should be sending the message that we are a strong and powerful country and we are prepared to help in certain circumstances, but we are not going to be the first responder to every single humanitarian crisis around the world. And that means that other countries are empowered to step forward and help. I am confident that a number of countries will. But it's a little unrealistic and unfair to say when a crisis crops up, as they have from time to time, and the other countries don't respond as quickly as we might like, is to say, well, see, this demonstrates that they'll never take care of these problems, and the United States always has to be there. It's like, yes, because they've been operating under an environment where they've been discouraged from doing anything, and it's not like they're going to turn on a dime. Here's what I think is likely to happen. And again, it's always dangerous to predict the future because it hasn't happened yet. I think that a combination of anxiety around the level of commitment on the part of the American people and again, sort of expressed, sort of made manifest by President Trump's victory, is sending a message to other countries, a little nervousness, a little bit of, which is inducing a little bit of hedging, a little bit of looking, searching for alternatives. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think some other countries are likely to take more seriously their security responsibilities. And very slowly, over time, we might see more countries developing military capabilities that have a dual purpose. They have security purposes for their own country, but they also are capable of helping to alleviate some of these challenges, and or for that matter, help the United States when we see a common challenge. That's where I think that we're likely to move slowly, fitfully. There'll be, you know, the blob will reassert itself and things like that. But I think that's more realistic because the United States could actually sustain that sort of a posture at 2.5% or 3% of GDP and have other countries spending 2% or 2.5% of GDP on defense. That seems to me to be a more sustainable model over the long term.
Yeah, I would think that an example of a country that has stepped up to take care of messes that it perceived as being in its national interest is France. I mean, they've intervened in various places in Africa.
Right.
These are several countries.
Right. These are countries. Many of these are African countries where the former French colonies. Another example is Australia. Australia has taken a number of actions. I mean, we know a lot about the Aussies helping the United States in Afghanistan and elsewhere. The Aussies have also taken steps in a number of countries, the Solomon Islands and East Timor. These are countries that are fairly, you know, crises, conflicts that are, you know, reasonably close. And they've taken steps without the United States being actively involved. So I think there are some faint signs that other countries take seriously both their security interests and the humanitarian impulse, and that sort of chips away at the argument that only the United States is capable of doing these things. I don't think that's true. That's not even true. That's not true today, even with the message that we've sent over several decades, and I think it would be less true going forward.
Yeah, let me interrupt Sal's possible follow-on and ask one of my own. Which in the piece about no more of the same, there's a sentence in there that I'm fascinated by. It's smart alternatives to primacy feature a significant role for the U.S. Navy and Air Force in providing security in the global commons while avoiding the downsides of onshore activism. Can you kind of unpeel that for me? Because it seems
sure.
to me that kind of goes a little bit against the grain of what you say earlier in that article.
I think that there's the fact that the U.S. Navy and the Air Force are capable of projecting power over great distances without necessarily the need for onshore bases and allies who provide basing rights gives them real, you know, it's obviously gives them real flexibility and the ability to go to a problem and go to a fight as opposed to trying to be everywhere and stopping bad things from happening. And so I do think it's a subtle difference in the way that we've used the Navy and the Air Force up to this point, but I'm saying, Will and I are saying, we would continue to have a strong role for the Navy. I'll tell you another article that didn't get nearly as much attention as I would have thought, given that it was written by the Chief of Naval Operations at the time, was Mike Mullen. Mike Mullen, back in 2007 or 8, thereabouts, talked about a 1,000-ship Navy. Well, he wasn't talking about 1,000 U.S. Navy ships. He was talking about 1,000 Navy ships of all the countries around the world that have common security interests. One of those common security interests is securing the commons, making sure that the major trading routes around the world remain free of pirates and bandits and other, you know, ne'er-do-wells and whatnot, trying to disrupt trade. And so when I think of, yes, the United States Navy would have a large role. I've already talked about how, you know, we have large coastlines. We're going to have a large Navy. That's not in dispute. The question is, how well does that Navy operate with other navies around the world? And are they also committed to helping to police the commons? That's what I thought. That's what I think that Will and I meant by that statement.
Well, while we're speaking of nations that might do that, you could have, when you look at China, you could take the entire U.S. population and have that number disappear from the Chinese nation, and they still have a billion people. Really
right,
big
right,
a nation.
Yes. Yes.
Frightening, but true. Same thing with India.
Yes.
But we'll leave India alone. Let's just look at China. They continue to grow. continue to have influence. You're actually seeing them, and you know the future is always dangerous. But if you believe the large part of destiny is demographics, and I happen to, a lot of the second half of this century is going to be associated with Africa. They have quite the mercantilist attitude towards Africa. And most of the rest of the world has static or declining populations. Large bulges of youth can tend to be disruptive, especially when the economic situation in the world is going toward being able to do more with fewer unskilled workers. Do you see any evidence that, as you mentioned, Australia and other smaller nations have a good humanitarian impulse in their periphery? China's mercantilist interest in Africa, do we have any indications that they may become or want to be that nation that when the inevitable disasters take place in Africa, that they may step in and justify their desired position as a global leader?
No, not necessarily. I'm less convinced that they would behave in that way. There was a really good article in the New York Times Magazine last week about some of the various places where China's made investments in Africa. I think that they are motivated, as you've already alluded to, they are motivated primarily by this insatiable appetite for stuff, for raw materials to sustain this impressive economic growth, and they know that they need these resources from all over the world, and so that I think explains mostly their, you know, their various investments and projects all over the place, including in Africa. It's possible that a local crisis, a civil conflict, or something like that would threaten those investments, and therefore a desire to protect them. The other problem, the difference, however, is the Chinese have quite a particular view about state sovereignty and about the rights of a given leadership in a given place to control what happens inside of their borders. The Chinese very simply don't like the idea of the responsibility to protect, or don't like the idea of the erosion of sovereignty that's occurred over the last several decades. So I think they're far less likely to want to be seen as contributing to that, as sort of trampling on or stepping on other countries' sovereignty. Maybe that'll change, but so far I think their instincts are to do it within the context of, you know, we're here with the understanding of the government in question, and maybe if we're asked to help, we will. But I can't see them sort of barging in as the United States and a few other states have chosen to do over the last few decades.
Well, Chris, we're winding down toward the end of our hour here. And before we go, first, I want to thank you for being with us today. It's been a very interesting hour. And then I want to ask you about any works you've got coming up that our listeners should be looking for, and works that you would point them to on this general subject matter.
Well, I would commend them to the War on the Rocks series. It was a whole series. It was derived from a study that my colleagues and I worked on last spring and summer. We're big War on the Rocks fans at Cato. They do some great work over there. And so if they want to learn more, they can. I did mention my book, The Power Problem, which is now almost 9 years old, but still has some life in it. And lastly, I just encourage them, if they like this conversation and they like where it went, they could certainly check out the Cato website, cato.org. My colleagues and I are writing on these sorts of issues constantly. And like I say, if they like what they heard, they're likely to appreciate some of the other things that my colleagues and have been saying over the years.
And on that note, that brings us to the end of the hour. Really enjoyed it. Christopher, and I do encourage everybody, please keep an eye, and a good place to follow you is over on Twitter, because I see where you link. Everybody just look up at Christopher Preble over at Twitter, and they should be able to keep it and keep up with you. And again, thank you very much, and I hope you have a great summer.
Thank you both very much. It's been great.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrat. Next week, we're taking a Mother's Day best of, but then please join us on the 21st. We're going to have returning guest, Dr. Dmitry Gornberg, to discuss all things Russia. But until then, again, thank you very much, and I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.